early September 1967. After months of training local Bolivian soldiers and gathering intel, American CIA agents finally had a lead on finding Che Guevara. Their biggest clue to his whereabouts? A man known as Paco.
You know, he respected Che, but he was very disappointed as a guerrilla. He didn't want to be a guerrilla. He wanted to live.
It was a breakthrough for CIA agent Felix Rodriguez, who had a personal feud against Guevara. But the closer they got to catching him, the clearer it became that capture meant death.
Because on one hand, he had his orders from the CIA to keep Che alive. And now he was receiving orders straight from his, from the Bolivians, basically from the high command, saying Che was going to be executed.
Welcome to Covert, a show about the shadowy world of international espionage and top-secret military operations.
I said, and we are convinced that Che Guevara is in the area. And we have to move the battalion right now. We want to get him.
I'm Jamie Rennell, and I'm going to take you inside history's greatest special operations missions to learn about the brave soldiers and operatives who risked their lives to terminate the world's most wanted, eliminate terrorist threats, and protect countless innocent lives.
And that's when Felix picks up the phone and says, well, communicates back to the Bolivian command, we need the Rangers in this area now because, another week or two, Che could be gone.
Che Guevara had been hiding out in Bolivia, trying to inspire revolution throughout South America. It had not been going well. And with the Bolivian Rangers and the CIA closing in, his end was nigh. But the last thing Rodriguez expected to do was to have to save him.
And then I prepare another one, about 100 words, in which I told him, you really want to keep him alive, you better move fast at high level in La Paz.
This is Che Guevara's Last Revolution, Part 2. Rodriguez and the Green Beret-trained Bolivian Rangers had just captured someone they were sure would lead them to Guevara, an insurgent by the name of Paco. Rodriguez had learned Paco was forced into being a guerrilla. It was likely he would talk.
They never told him he was going to be a guerrilla. So when he left La Paz, thinking that he was going to go to Cuba and the Soviet Union, going through another Latin American country, instead of giving him documentation and a little plane to fly to Paraguay, Uruguay, he was told that he wasn't a guerrilla and he was given a rifle.
Paco had been wounded by the Rangers' assault on his unit, but because he was a prisoner, they wouldn't take him to the hospital.
So I did pay for a nurse from a hospital to come over and to treat him. He had a lot of worms in his tool that saved his life, but otherwise he had got gangrene, so the worm would eat every bad things in there. So they put different materials in there to kill the worms and antibiotic while at the 8th Division headquarters, and we were able to save his life. And also, I treated him well. I offered to pass information to his family and brought him newspapers and magazines to read.
Rodriguez knew getting on his good side was key to getting the information they needed. Once Paco was healed, Rodriguez could now begin the most important part of his mission thus far, interrogating the person who he thought could lead him to Che. Little by little, Paco opened up.
So after I talked to him, I also found out that he had a tremendous memory. In the short time that I interrogated him while he was in the hospital, before I went to ask for him as a prisoner, I could tell that the guy had tremendous memory. He would cite a location where he was months before, and he could give you the address and the name of 15 people. And that's very unusual.
After 2 weeks of interrogation, Rodriguez realized the great revolutionary Che was in even more trouble than they thought. From Paco, he was able to find out that Che's unit was fractured. There was a lot of infighting. There was no harmony. This was a dysfunctional revolutionary band. Kevin Maurer is an award-winning journalist and co-author of Hunting Che.
Che really wanted to train his guerrillas to be tough. He really had a focus on this old Cuban style in the mountains, the hardship of being a guerrilla. So what he wanted to do was harden up his force, and while that was part of the reasons why he was marching them around the countryside. What happened though was that he marched them into weakness. Essentially, they weren't able to scrounge from the people because the people weren't supporting them, And it, what it did is it degraded his force to the point where they were really combat ineffective. I mean, it was easy to give Paco a sandwich and a drink and clean clothes, and all of a sudden Paco's a happy guy and is really willing to help at that point.
They learned about the formation of Che's group. The whole unit was divided into three groups that would march meters apart: the vanguard, center, and rear guard.
Well, he would give us in general terms individuals that he knew that were within the guerrilla. He told us specifically, you know, about the vanguard, center, and rear guard. He gave us the alias name that he knew the people forming the vanguard, the center, and the rear guard. The vanguard was about 8 or 10 of the guerrillas that would move ahead of him, about 1 kilometer, less than a mile, in front of him. He would be in the middle, what they call the center, with the main force, and then he would have another group in the rear guard, about 1 kilometer, like I said, less than a mile behind him, and they would move that way. So his information was extremely valuable to us.
Paco also revealed more of the inner turmoil of Guevara's guerrillas. They knew he was having trouble convincing the locals to join his cause, but his own soldiers were starting to have problems as well.
Yes, he also told them the, you know, all the problems that they had in being able to get food. A lot of times they went hungry and thirsty, and then there were some of them who drowned in the Rio Grande, because when you cross the Rio Grande, you need to have a guy from the area, especially in the rainy season, to let you know where to cross. Otherwise, it's very, very fast currency, and it's not a simple river out here. And the guerrilla lost a couple of people in different times trying to cross the Rio Grande by themselves.
After a few weeks, Rodriguez decided to show Paco the photograph he found among Guevara's effects. The photo of the mysterious woman who handled Che's finances. She was the key to Che's funding and communication network.
I didn't know really much about her. I know that she was with the guerrilla. She visited them at one point in time, and she was back working in the cities. And that's all I knew at the time. And so I brought these pictures to Paco, and Paco was the one who identified Loyola Guzman and told us, this is La Coyola Guzman, who is from the university. That's how we identified her.
La Coyola was Loyola Guzman. She was 25 years old and a graduate of the elite Communist Party activists training school in Moscow. She was also a member of the Bolivian Communist Youth. Paco said she was working out of a secret cell in La Paz. The Bolivian soldiers wasted no time and tracked her down. They swooped in to arrest her. Guzman was distraught under interrogation, but gave intel about 11 members of the guerrillas. After that, she said she would rather kill herself than betray her comrades.
You know, the Bolivian troops bring her in to question her, and she was so distraught about what they found, and she ended up telling them about Che and the guerrillas, and she was so distraught about it, she tried to kill herself by throwing herself out, you know, a third-story window, and she survived. And later she gave interviews saying how sorry she was that she gave any information to the Bolivians.
Despite her limited information, this was a victory for the CIA. Capturing Guzman had cut Che off from his funds and communication. The rebel force was now completely isolated and on their own. All the CIA needed to do now was initiate an operation to finally bring Che in, but Rodriguez still had no clues as to his current location. Then came a breakthrough. Some of the Rangers came back from a routine patrol. They arrived back at camp carrying 3 dead rebel fighters.
And the 3 men are brought into town, this remote area, on the back of mules. When they take the bodies off the mules, he looks at them.
They were prematurely discovered because they tell the story that was a camp for marijuana cultivating. And then when the police came there looking for marijuana, that's when they encountered the base camps.
Among their bodies, Rodriguez found a driver's license and documents. All the names were false, but the licenses had photographs.
And he recognizes right away that these are 3 men who are with, you know, Che's front guard, which means that Che has to be in the area.
One of them, called Miguel, was the captain of Che's front column.
Che split his force into 3 vanguards that would march in certain intervals so that you would never caught all of them together, and that he was able to anticipate when he was going to run into the Bolivian soldiers. So when the first group ran into the Bolivian soldiers, he would know and then be able to maneuver to make sure that they can stay fluid. That's sort of the key to fighting as a gorilla. So he split his force in order to separate them so that they were hard to pin down.
From Paco, Rodriguez had learned that Che always moved in the middle column. It was protected 1,000 meters behind the front vanguard. Using the location of where Miguel was killed, Rodriguez was then able to determine Che's position. And now that he knew where Che was, he had to strike immediately.
And that's when Felix picks up the phone and says, well, communicates back to the Bolivian command, we need the Rangers in this area now because, you know, another week or two, Che could be gone. He could be anywhere. He could be back in Cuba. But we know where he is right now. We can have him trapped. But we need men to come up here and go into this particular area of the red zone and find him.
Rodriguez urgently called the U.S. Green Berets command. He needed them to release the Bolivian 2nd Rangers Battalion from training and instead send them to combat Che.
And we are convinced that Che Guevara is in the area. And we have to move the battalion right now. We want to get him. And he understood that. He took the advice and he ordered immediately that day the battalion to move into operation.
At first, there was pushback. They said, they're still training. They haven't even had their graduation ceremonies yet. How are we going to send them out there? And Felix was adamant. Felix said, we need them. We need them now because in another week, Che could be gone. He could be anywhere in the country. He could be back in Cuba. This is our one chance to get him. And that was the significance.
The urgency in Rodriguez's voice made it clear that it was now or never. The Bolivian battalion were dispatched immediately to hunt Che down. One of the trainers, Gerald Peterson, described the landscape of the area they were to stake out.
But the area that they were working in was a very rough mountainous area and a very, very poor area for insurgents to hide in. So we were able to basically design tactics specifically to catch this group of insurgents. And some of the time-tested methods are the hammer and anvil, which you force the insurgents against, say, a river or a mountain range, against a natural object, and then with big force as a hammer and hammer them kill and capture them.
On the stakeout, 17 men suddenly walked into a high-sided canyon where they thought Che would be. The Rangers assumed they could only be guerrilla fighters. If Che was in fact in that middle column, the canyon could provide the perfect terrain to utilize the hammer and anvil training maneuver.
Essentially, Che is in two canyons. There's two canyons that run parallel to each other, and they know that Che is in one of them. So Gary Prado, the Ranger company commander, he takes his command group and goes to the bottom where they intersect, and then they set a blocking position on the one canyon, the left canyon, and then they sweep down from the right canyon and then into the left canyon. Tactically, it's perfect. It's exactly what they were trained to do, which is they set up a blocking position on the high ground, and then they sweep through the canyon trying to flush Che out.
When they engaged the guerrillas, instead of shooting a couple of them and just sitting down and reporting, hey, we killed some of the guerrillas, they continued to pursue, and that's what they did. They ran these guys into the ground, literally. And Che was running with one of his insurgents, and they literally ran him into the ground.
Che and his guerrillas were trapped. As they tried to escape, the soldiers picked them off, one by one. Che's rebel force was now locked in a heated battle. One guerrilla was shot in the leg. The shooter stood above him, ready to finish him off. Don't shoot me. I am Che Guevara, and worth more to you alive than dead.
Hey, podcast listeners. This is your producer, Rachel Jacobs. If we've learned anything from Covert, it's that history is brutal, beautiful, and often ridiculous. Like, have you ever wondered what Pablo Escobar and hippos have in common? Have you ever seen a British lawyer don one of those white powdered wigs and wondered why? And did a rainmaking supervillain really almost drown San Diego? On Ridiculous History, Ben Bolin and Noel Brown explore some of the strangest, most fascinating stories from across the span of human civilization. And there are some really silly things that have happened in the past. How about the American War on Chinese restaurants? You can learn the answers to these questions and more by subscribing to Ridiculous History on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you find your podcasts.
They bring Che back to a schoolhouse. He's there with another one of his soldiers, Willie. And they put him in a schoolhouse in the middle of La Higuera, which is a small little mountain town.
Back in his office, Rodriguez paced. For 10 years, Che had eluded U.S. intelligence, and now his fate lay in the hands of the poorly trained Bolivian army.
When Che was captured, we heard the news, you know, it was a tremendous feeling. First of all, we had to verify that. That's when I got into the plane, and then we were able to verify that and come back and report that to the colonel. And that evening, I had bought a couple of bottles of scotch some time ago for this specific occasion. I didn't thought I was going to be using it that soon. And we had a toast at the hotel. And I recall Colonel Centeno saying, "This is the peace in my country and the end of the guerrilla in Bolivia."
Soon after, Rodriguez had to get to work. The first thing he did was photograph all of Che's captured documents. Among Che's effects were even more diaries, which could give them a better idea of his movement inside Bolivia.
Felix Rodriguez recognizes immediately just how important this is, and he has a little camera, and he's going to start taking pictures of the diary for the CIA so they can process it.
But then, Rodriguez learned something alarming. The Bolivian officers holding Che were telling him that he would soon be executed, and this was directly against Rodriguez's own orders to keep him alive.
Felix's mission there, though, is really to get a hold of all the papers, get paper pictures taken of him, and try to save Che's life, because the CIA at that point had told him before he left, is we want this guy alive. If you can get Che alive, get him alive. So Felix has got a kind of two missions there. One, he wants to get all the intelligence he can get, but he also wants to keep Che alive if he can.
Rodriguez, meanwhile, sent a message to his CIA handlers that they had captured Che. A few minutes later, he sent a second message.
And then I prepared another one, about 100 words, in which I told them, you really want to keep him alive, you better move fast at high level in La Paz.
The call for Che's death was ordered by Bolivian President René Barrientos. It was common Bolivian practice to kill prisoners rather than capture them, and so Rodriguez had to appeal to the Bolivian military's top brass to halt the execution. The answer came in a coded call, sealing Che's fate.
We had a very simple code: 500 Che Guevara, 600 dead, 700 alive. I actually had the orders of 500, 600. So it was repeated to me. So I waited until Colonel Centeno came back from the operational area. I called him aside and said, "Mi Coronel, they have been ordered from your high command to eliminate the prisoner." I told him the code that we had received. My instruction is try to keep him alive at all costs. He looked at me and said, "Felix, we have worked empirically. We are very grateful to your help, but these are orders from my president and my commander-in-chief."
Rodriguez was conflicted. They were in Bolivia, meaning the Bolivian president had the final say. And in any case, Guevara was a war criminal to the Bolivian population. But his direct orders said otherwise. Could he do something about it?
Because on one hand, he had his orders from the CIA to keep Che alive. And now he was receiving orders straight from from the Bolivians, basically from the high command, saying Che was going to be executed. And so at first he thought, well, how can we plan his escape? How can I get him out of here and smuggle him back?
I thought maybe I could call the telephone line, and I could tell the pilot, and he had no communication with them, that my embassy was able to convince the president to keep Che alive, to bring him back. Because as a soldier, you don't execute a prisoner. At the same time, I knew what had happened in Cuba, and it was the Bolivian who had ordered that. And I hope I never had to face that situation again in my life. It was a very, very hard situation, and very emotional one.
And finally, he thought, you know, this is their country. He thought about everything that Che had done to his own people, to the Cubans. And he realized at that point, the Bolivians make the rules here, and he wasn't going to fight it.
In the end, Rodriguez came to the difficult conclusion that Che had been captured in Bolivia, and so the Bolivian president's rules were law.
No, afterward, I reflected on it, and I believe that letting history run itself was the best thing that could have happened. I could have tried to save his life. At the same time, I felt there was a responsibility I wasn't about to take. So I let history run itself. Nevertheless, it is not easy for a soldier to go back and remember that you ordered the execution of an individual who was captured. If it was my decision, he would have been alive. And it would have been probably a big mistake.
In the schoolhouse, Guevara was evading his questioning. Colonel Zentano, the Bolivian commander, was having no luck in getting him to talk.
I recall Zentano asking him questions and she looked at him and not saying a word. At one point he was upset and he told, you are a foreigner, you are invaded my country. The least you can do is have the courtesy to answer me. And she would not say a word.
Rodriguez decided he would try to get some information himself. It would be the first time he would come face-to-face with Guevara, the man he had hunted for so long. And now, it would be their final confrontation. Kneeling down, Rodriguez told Che the news of his fate.
And around 12:30 in the afternoon, Bolivian time, here comes this lady where I was. Say, well, the radio is already giving the news that he died from combat wounds. So at that point in time, I thought there's not much I can do anymore. So I got into the room, I stood in front of him, I looked at him and said, Commander, I'm sorry, I tried my best. He perfectly understood what I was saying. He turned white like a piece of paper. But he said, it's better this way, that you have never been captured alive. Then he took out the pipe that he got here and said, I'd like to give this pipe to a soldadito who treated me well. And at that point in time, Sergeant Mario Terán, who was the one executing everybody in the area, came into the room. Yo quiero la pipa, mi capitán. I want the pipe. And just say, no, a ti no te la doy. I would not give it to you. So I asked him twice to leave the room. On the third time, he finally left. Yo quiero la pipa, mi capitán. Digo, salga de aquí. So finally, he left the room. And I looked at Che and said, will you give it to me? He looked at me for a few seconds. And he goes, sí, a ti sí te la doy. Yes, I will give it to you. He gave me the pipe, put it in my pocket. And he says, anything you want for your family, if I can pass the message. And then he changed the expression and said, and if you can, tell my wife to remarry and try to be happy. That was the last word. We looked at each other, he approached me, we shook hands, and we embraced. And he stood back and stood in attention, thinking I was going to be the one to shoot him.
The two spoke for a while, convivial. They mostly made small talk. Anytime Rodriguez attempted to get information, Che was still on guard.
And then we start talking. Whenever I ask him question that was of tactical interest to us, he would smile and say, you know, I cannot answer that.
As a final act of closure, Rodriguez asked if they could take a photo together. It would be the last photo ever taken of the young rebel leader.
Then I gave my camera to the pilot. And I stood next to him, and some soldiers next to us put my hand around him and said, Commander, look at the little bird. And he laughed. It's a Cuban saying, mira el pajarito. You tell that to kids, you know, look at the little bird. And actually, when I gave the films in La Paz to the CIA, I told them there's a picture of Che with me laughing. Of course, when he saw the picture was going to be taken, he changed his expression.
Finally, the time for execution was nigh. A young Bolivian soldier named Mario Terán had volunteered to do it. The process was complicated. It was common for the Bolivian government to execute prisoners, but it wouldn't look good politically. And news outlets had already announced Che had been killed in battle. So Rodriguez instructed Tehran to shoot Che in the leg, not in the chest. With the help from Rodriguez and another soldier, Che was brought to his feet and taken outside. There, in the Bolivian sun, in the back of an old schoolhouse, 39-year-old Che Guevara said his last words. I know you've come to kill me. Shoot, coward. You are only going to kill a man.
It's so, since it's the only time that happened in my life, it's very, very difficult to describe. It was a very solemn moment of a lot of tension. You knew you had to do it. You knew it's not the appropriate thing to do as a soldier. It's very hard. It's very hard.
In the end, Tehran shot him 9 times. So ended the life of the face of the revolution, the man who had set out to overthrow what he saw as unjust governments, was dead.
Because he really is, I think, the father of the modern revolutionary movement. And whenever there was a skirmish, whenever there was a group of people who thought that they were going to fight against what they thought was social injustice, they would invoke Che's name.
Che Guevara was a charismatic, provocateur, revolutionary, gangster, murderer. He was hugely unsuccessful in Bolivia, and I think he met the fate he deserved.
Che's body was flown to a local town where he was laid out for public display. It was a message. Revolutionary terrorism was still terrorism and would not be tolerated. Back in Washington, the CIA celebrated a victory. They had been stalking Che for over 10 years and had now finally gotten their man. And the operation had been done with minimal resources. They had successfully trained local soldiers to work alongside their own elites.
A lot of the techniques that were used, you know, the accelerated training, breaking them off into groups, I mean, they're still being used, you know, by the Green Berets today, especially in Afghanistan.
The CIA was also excited about the way Rodriguez broke new ground in Bolivia with his pioneering investigative techniques.
I think that his insistence on keeping Paco alive, I think the way he exploited intelligence, I think the way he elicited information, the way he dealt with the Bolivians on a one-to-one basis made it possible for them to do the capture that they did. The way he went about it was revolutionary, and I think it set the course for counterinsurgency in the ensuing decades. What Felix understood instinctively was that you don't win hearts and minds by killing people. You win hearts and minds by protecting people.
6 weeks after Che's capture, Rodriguez was back in South America training an elite Ecuadorian intelligence unit. In 1969, the man who caught Che Guevara finally became an American citizen and enlisted in the United States Army. During the Vietnam War, he flew over 300 helicopter missions and was shot down 5 times. During his career with the CIA, Rodriguez was awarded the Intelligence Star for actions of extraordinary heroism. But despite all this, Rodriguez will always be remembered for his CIA mission to hunt down Che Guevara.
You know, I was 26 years at the time, 26-year-old. I have done a lot of other things that I consider probably more important. But I consider, for example, when I was in the Bay of Pigs, things that I had to go through during the other operation in Vietnam, are probably more important to me in a lot of ways. Nevertheless, this happens to be the one because of the figure of Che Guevara.
Che's fighting spirit still lives on.
Guerrilla warfare is prevalent to this day. So it didn't stop. In Bolivia, it stopped. I don't think there was ever really guerrilla warfare in Bolivia to a certain degree.
I see it in a sad way that people do not really know who he was. And it's very ironic on the part that the one who are giving him that image is Cuba, who actually sent him to be killed. But a lot of people doesn't even know really who he was. There are people who are wearing his t-shirt who doesn't know who he is.
In the next episode, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi took credit for heinous acts of terror in Iraq, including beheadings and bombings, and was a known accomplice of Osama bin Laden.
You know, you could say Zarqawi could be responsible for upwards of almost 100,000 deaths by starting the civil war in Iraq.
And it would take a joint effort between the United States and British special forces to take him down.
Zarqawi's motive was that he wanted to be the leader of al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. And he saw this struggle as, you know, part of the larger al-Qaeda struggle for dominance in the Middle East. But for Zarqawi, it was really all about him. And, you know, his strategy was to start a civil war in Iraq between Sunni and Shia, and he believed American forces would get mired down in that civil conflict. And then the American public would demand that we be withdrawn. What he didn't count on is that we would stay.
That's next time on Covert. Covert is an Audio Boom and World Media Rights co-production hosted by me, Jamie Rennell. It is produced by Audio Boom's Ben Hosley, Rachel Jacobs, and Karen Bevan, and by Pascal Hughes for World Media Rights. We had additional production help from World Media Rights by Gerald Zabengwa. David McNabb is the series creative director, and the executive producers for Audio Boom are Brendan Regan and Stuart Last. If you haven't already, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Covert Podcast. You can also follow us on Spotify or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you find your favorite shows. And if you've got some time, give us a review.